On air, online, or on the go, you're listening to Radio 91, 91.1 KRCB-FM Windsor, and 90.9 K215-CQ Santa Rosa. Alpi Radio is coming up next, but don't forget, KRCB Radio is your public radio station, and we depend on your support. We're here tonight to take your tax-deductible donation, and we've got some great thank you gifts, including the ever-so-popular Sonoma Strong T-shirt. You can call us right now at 707-584-2020, that's 584-2020, or you can go online and donate now at krcb.org. Just click on the red donate button at the top of the page. It's 8 p.m. Stay with us. Outbeat Radio is next.
Welcome to Outbeat Radio on KRCB Windsor, Santa Rosa, a program that focuses on issues by, for, and or about members of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender communities. You can hear Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m.
This is Living Proof, and we're your hosts. I'm Dr. Diana Grayer, and next to me is my co-host and wife, Sheridan Gold. Tonight in studio, we have a biracial, bicultural couple who have been together for 27 years. Yes, meet Judy Evanier and Mary Mendoza. Welcome, you two.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. Good to be here.
Thank you. We're so excited to hear you, hear all about you.
Yeah, Cat got your tongue, though. This will be the one time in your lives where it's like, Anyway, welcome to Living Proof, and we're so happy to have you in the studio tonight. Both of you work with seniors, and you'll get to talk a little bit about what you do in your jobs and your passions and your hobbies and things like that, and especially how you were affected by the fires. That would be very interesting, and your clients and things. And we'll have many questions about that, and you and your relationship, and with each other and with the bigger world. But first, here's news and events with Outbeat member and our engineer and good buddy, Greg Maralia.
And I rise up, I rise like the day, I rise up, I rise unafraid, I rise.
This is Greg Maralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of November 5th, 2017. Every 2 years, member states of the United Nations General Assembly come together to negotiate the Olympic Truce Resolution to ensure peace during the Olympics, as well as the week before and after. Since 2015, Principle 6 of the Olympic Charter has included a ban on discrimination on sexual orientation, but two of the countries are trying to remove all references to this year's resolution. Jessica Stern, executive director of Outright Action International, said, quote, Egypt and Russia are not simply fighting over symbolic language, but over the levels of violence governments are allowed to use against LGBT people. After systematic attacks on LGBT people in their own countries, they are now setting their sights on promoting violence and discrimination in every country around the world. The Olympic Games are supposed to be a time for sport, technique, pride, and community, not for politicking, hatred, and violence, end quote. And here in the U.S., the Associated Press reported a federal judge has blocked President Trump's ban on transgender military members while a case works its way through the legal system. U.S. District Judge Colleen Kohler-Cotelli wrote that transgender military members have filed a lawsuit and are likely to win their case, and barred the Trump administration from changing policy in the meantime. Sarah Warbelow, HRC's legal director, said the preliminary injunction is an important step in the ongoing efforts to protect transgender service members from the dangerous discriminatory policies of Donald Trump and Mike Pence. And in Texas, a car dealership claimed protection under the First Amendment last week in a lawsuit by a former employee who says the business fired him because he is transgender. Bradley Rudkin, the former general sales manager of Roger Beasley Mitsubishi in Austin, Texas, filed a lawsuit on August 1st claiming wrongful termination from his job. Ruskin, a transgender man, claims the business fired him without warning solely for being transgender. Lawyers for the car dealership filed a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, claiming the business had a right to fire Rudkin as a matter of free speech. Attorneys for the Mitsubishi dealership have argued that firing Rudkin makes a public statement and therefore the business was within its legal right to do so. Prior to the dismissal, Rudkin had won a number of awards for his successful management. During the first year of his employment, the dealership team under Rudkin posted a $750,000 upswing in revenue from the previous year. And in San Francisco, the community is invited to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Harvey Milk's election to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors at the grand lighting of Harvey's Halo and the unveiling of Hope Will Never Be Silent, produced by Illuminate, the team behind the Bay Lights, and the lighting of the Conservatory of Flowers for the Summer of Love. This event will happen at the corner of Castro and Market this Wednesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. and is free to everyone. For a calendar of LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. And for all the LGBT news headlines we're following, go to our website at outbeatnews.com. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
And if you just joined us, this is Living Proof with Diana and Sheridan, and I'm Sheridan. And we're in studio this evening with Judy Evenier and Mary Mendoza. Hello, both of you.
Hello again.
Hi.
So good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I have a question to start off with. We like to get our audience comfortable with our guests. So can you tell, I mean, I guess Mary, you can go first, just share about... like, what do you do in your day? What, you know, what's your profession? You know, whatever you feel like you want to share around that area in your life.
Okay. Well, my name is Mary. I'm a care manager for the Jewish and Family Children's Services in San Rafael. I work with senior citizens. I have been doing that for the past 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I provide case management to senior citizens, ensuring they stay home as long as possible. And I'm like a social worker, but bachelor's level. Whereas my honey...
I'm an LCSW, licensed clinical social worker, and I've been in the field for years.
What years? 3?
About almost 30.
Wow, you only look like you're 30.
Bless you. So, and I do clinical work and case management as well. Work with seniors. I do a lot of work with medical social work, chronic illness. My private practice, I do specialize in trauma and chronic illness. Those are kind of the areas I've been working in for the last 25, 30 years. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you've been licensed for 30?
I've been licensed, let's see, since 1997.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And Mary and I just moved up from Southern California about 5 years ago. And I used to work at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, and Mary used to work at UCLA. So we both kind of have backgrounds in medical social work.
Were you working with seniors back there also?
Various populations at UCLA Medical Center.
I was hired to be the HIV social worker, and luckily things got better for people with HIV, and so they actually closed the unit at Cedars, and so I... worked with oncology and palliative care for many years.
Mm. And I worked at UCLA Medical Center for 22 years.
Oh, wow.
Then you get a certain age and they let you go because it's too costly to keep me. So that's when we decided to move out here to Northern California because we always vacationed up here, Russian River, Point Reyes National Seashore. So we said, let's move. We took the big, bold move of moving up from Los Angeles.
Did you know anybody when you moved up here? You have friends or anything? Nothing?
Wow.
Nobody?
Nobody.
You ended up in Petaluma? Yes. Little old Petaluma?
Little old Petaluma. That's where we ended up.
Wow.
So they kick you to the curb. That's not fair. Oh, yeah. I hear so much of that.
Yeah, they put you out to pasture, so to speak.
Yeah, and so and Judy said, okay, honey. She was just willing to quit her job and say, let's go, let's take the drive?
Well, actually, it kind of happened at the same time.
Yeah.
I got a job up here, and we decided to make the move. And Mary was looking for work while she was still at UCLA, and that's when they cut her department. So
it all was synchronicity. It all happened, and we came up, and Judy stayed up here 3 months by herself?
6 months.
6 months by herself, and I would take the trips out here every weekend or every other weekend. Right.
Would you drive or fly or what?
Drive. Mm. It was tough. I started getting a tick in my eye because of all the stress.
You still have it?
Yeah. No, don't tell me I still have it.
We're laughing, y'all, because she's laughing, okay?
Yeah. But no, it's the best thing we've ever done. Mm. I was born and raised in L.A., and I really, really did get homesick. But since then, we've met great people. There's great food. And so just great community. And we love it.
Mm-hmm. I admire people who can just pack up and leave, you know?
I can't believe I did it.
Yeah, I think we didn't really realize what we were doing.
Well, how did your family, is your family down in L.A. too, Judy, or just Mary's?
Just Mary's.
Okay. So, Mary, how did your family take it when you said you were moving?
They don't show. Judy could probably answer that better. Judy, how do you think they took it?
Your sister wasn't really happy. Yeah. I think they all kind of blame me for taking you away from them.
Oh. Why did you defer? Why did you pass it on to Judy? I'm curious, Mary.
I love my sisters a lot, and sometimes I don't want to see truth about them.
Oh. Uh-huh.
Like how if they get persnickety, I don't want to see it or whatever. Okay. I'm the oldest daughter in a family of 10.
Whoa.
Yeah, so kind of raised them.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes Judy will point things out and I don't want to see it or I can't hear it. Or
does that put tension in between both of you in your relationship?
I think we're kind of used to it at this point.
Yeah.
We point things out to each other lovingly. And
yeah.
And is it received or is it like, shut the
After
heck
all these
up.
Years, I think most of the time it's received, but we've learned.
Yeah. I've learned to be open and more vulnerable. Like even today, something happened with my sister and I mentioned it to Judy, and was able to share with Judy vulnerably that it's hard for me to see my sister in that light. And Judy knows now, years later, not to say anything. If I'm open, just leave me open. Don't say anything. Mm. Yeah, so that's one thing we've learned. Mm. And I have to share here that I underwent a kidney transplant.
You what?
Kidney transplant.
What about it?
I had one.
Oh. Mm.
And my sister gave me her kidney. Yeah.
Wow.
So that's another reason for the real closeness and protectiveness. And
yes. How long ago was that?
Yeah.
1998.
February's going to be 20 years.
Yeah, February will be 20 years.
Mm.
Yeah.
Bless her heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's been, but that and staying together, that was a real test of our relationship, the 27 years. That came in, 10 years into it?
Well, I don't remember exactly, but there were 3 years of you being sick on dialysis before the transplant.
Oh, no. Wow.
Yeah.
And which part, Mary, tested the relationship?
The part that we underwent that and me being sick and just our different ways of coping. Oh. I'm into denial and it's not happening, but I don't consider it denial. I consider it having a positive attitude and there's only so much I can deal with. Judy, on the other hand, needs to know the Jewish, needs to know, Mexicans live for today. That's the way it is.
And Jews, they worry about everything.
Yeah. So Judy would ask 1,001 questions, and I wouldn't want to know anything.
Oh, wow.
And so that was a real big stressor. Real big.
How did you come to some kind of understanding on?
Well, actually, I have to say the social worker at UCLA, the dialysis social worker, was really helpful in this because being a social worker, I knew that that might be helpful for me to learn how to deal with it a little bit differently because, you know, Mary's style was so different than mine. And so having a talk with her or two really helped me understand how, you know, our differences were just that, just differences. And it's okay for us to have different styles, but we needed to sort of let them be, let us balance each other out instead of it being a source of conflict. And I guess I sort of learned how to back off and let Mary deal with her illness in her own way and, you know, let her be the sort of captain of her medical ship rather than me trying to control everything.
Was that hard for you?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In what way?
Well, I just, you know, for me, being in control made things feel a lot more safe and secure. And for Mary to kind of let go the way she says she does is how she feels like she's in control by not having to think about things.
And yeah, I consider it a positive attitude. And Judy would come to me, you're being in denial. I'm like, no, I know everything I'm going through. I'm here, I'm present, but I'd rather have a party and bring the employees food to dialysis and have a good time at it. Why, you know, why stress about it? It is what it is. Whereas I would see other patients worried about their potassium levels and their whatever levels and their labs, and they'd be all stressing. And I wasn't into that. I was like, whatever.
Is that part of your like nature that you don't like to stress, that you don't stress?
Yeah, I really got that from my mom. My mom did pass that on, that one thing. She would always say, don't worry. Mm. Don't worry. And then Mexicans live for the day. I mean, that's my culture. And I really, really believe that. You know, live for today. You don't know if you have tomorrow. And look at the fires. You don't know if you have tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So live in the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So one of the things that kind of has been nice in our relationship is how we've kind of both moved towards the middle. You know, Mary's learned a little bit more about being sort of more engaged and present in some of our life. What should I call it? Life what? Experiences. And I've learned how to let go of things a lot more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I think both of our cultural influences have sort of impacted each other in a really positive way in that regard.
Mm-hmm. I have a great story. If we have time, I'd like to share about us going to Mexico. And we went to, it was a trip in the LA Times billed as the trip to the Grand Canyon of Mexico on a Pullman, renovated Pullman train. So we purchased the tickets. When we get to the train station in Mexicali, the train is not converted. It's an old 1940s train. And instead of the gondola, it has just a flat bed and very rickety platform to get from the train to the flat bed. Well, Judy's nature was to worry. And I was like, Judy, all we have is today. Let's live for the day. We're in Mexico. What are we going to do? And before us, there was a lady who was like Judy. She couldn't let go. But Judy in the end did let go. She did. But this lady couldn't, and she was an elderly woman. They had to medevac her out.
She had a heart attack.
Because she was just so upset at the trip, at the billing, at everything. And it was Judy saw for herself that you just got to let go. What are you going to do? You know?
So and that it ended up being a really fun vacation. So this trip that was, you know, advertised as, you know, travel in the 1940s Pullman, which was really, could have been a really neat experience, you know, wasn't exactly what they advertised. But, you know, we had fun eating our peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on the train. And
stale potato chips.
And playing Scrabble. And
with the porters and the Mexican workers. And we played Scrabble in Spanish.
And then the advertisement was that it had this beautiful gondola where we could be outside and see Copper Canyon from the outside. And, you know, of course, then we get there and we see it's just a flatbed. And when we would stop in some towns, we would pick up the Federales and they would come and join us, about 50 of them on the back of this train with their guns, and we didn't know what they were doing on our train. So it was an experience. And everybody on the train except for us, I think, stayed drunk the whole time. And, you know, we just had a good time because they were having fun and they were funny, and we had a good time with them.
How long ago was this?
That was like 1993 when we were new.
And when you were new?
Yeah.
Wow.
So what year did you get together?
1990.
Okay.
Yeah, 1990.
Wow.
One of our first dates was going to the first gay pride, huh? Remember?
Yeah, that was fun.
So we want to know how you met, because I'm always curious about the communication when two different races come together, two different religious, you know, cultural upbringing come together. I'm really fascinated by that because that's what we have here, Sharon and myself, right? I know you talked about around your surgery and around your dialysis and that medical piece, but you met each other where, and how did that shape in the beginning of the relationship? 27 years later, you know, you stay with it. So I'm just curious about the beginning.
Well, Mary and I met through friends. We had some friends that used to have a game night at their house every Friday night. And we were both invited separately. And that's how we got to know each other, through those Friday night gatherings. And frankly, I mean, I had just finished graduate school. I was like really, you know, into being this new social worker. I just finished USC and, you know, learning and, you know, going to, you know, book readings and musical things. And I was very involved in my synagogue, the Gay and Lesbian Temple in Los Angeles. And that's kind of what my life was. And, you know, Mary had a very different kind of life. And quite frankly, I never even imagined that I would be with someone not Jewish, let alone of another, you know, culture. So we were friends initially, and we hung out together for a long time.
We went to our first gay pride as friends, remember?
Yeah.
Yeah, when we saw a pretty girl, we would lift our legs up. Sitting there just, woo-hoo!
Yeah. I just never thought that this would ever become a romantic relationship.
Yeah, Judy was much more intellectual. Yes. Yeah. And I was much more simple. I was like just a simple person, you know? Yeah.
She's not negative simple.
She's not.
But just worrisome, like free spirit.
Exactly. Yeah, so. Exactly. Didn't worry. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And so we would go watch movies, and Mary really taught me how to love movies and music and dancing and things that I really wasn't into.
Yeah. Judy was more into poetry readings and intellectual pursuits, wouldn't you say?
So
she moved you up, and you moved her out.
Hey, that's a real good way
like
to put
that.
It like yesterday we went to the TEDx Sonoma. So that's really intellectual and really great. And then like Judy, next weekend we're gonna go to Air Supply concert.
So throwback from the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. So it's that diversity. It's that.
Hey, but I've gone to war and to Los Lobos with you many a time at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles.
It sounds like what you both are talking about is that you have balance in your relationship.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Which definitely is probably a really good thing, because you're not being asked, either one of you is not asking the other to give up who she is. You're just supplementing. You're sharing your life with your beloved, and they're learning, and she's learning how to love it too.
Yes, definitely. I would agree with
you. I think the best example of that is, you know, the Christmas Hanukkah thing that I think a lot of interfaith couples go through. And, you know, I came from an Orthodox background, and so having Christmas in my home was not something I would ever really want. And Mary wanted a Christmas tree for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And I kind of
wouldn't
agree to it. Mm. So finally one year I just said, well, she really wants one. Let's go for it. And we were going to go get the tree.
No, you brought a tree home.
Oh, that's right. I did bring the tree home.
Because I said, you know, Judy, this might be a source point. Mm. And finally I said, you know, this is really important to me. I think, you know, I just need the tree. And sure enough, the tree, she surprised me with the tree.
Oh, yeah. Did you start crying?
No, but then it wasn't important after that.
What?
Yeah. Ever since I had that tree, I didn't need it again.
Like if I had known that, I would have done it a lot sooner.
It was I'm just curious about working that out, though, because you're not the only ones, I don't think, have to deal with that, you know? So, I mean, Sharon and I, it was similar, but it was different. It was more her father had something to say rather than share. But anyways, I'm just curious about how did you decide that it's going to be Mary's way? I mean, Judy's way and not your way.
Because for me, it was more cultural. The celebration was more about the tamales and the cultural festivities. It wasn't the religious. Mm. For Judy, it was religious. Like her experience as a Jewish, her parents were Holocaust survivors. It was more loaded than mine. Mm. So that's why I knew it was more important to her. But for me to have a pagan tree, that's when I said, this is not symbolic of any religion. It's a tree. Mm. It's pagan. Like it doesn't matter. It just and so that's when I started to feel sore about it. Mm-hmm. So the day that Judy brought it home, it was like, oh, great. Mm. Never needed.
So do you get trees now? Do you get trees every year?
No, they're too expensive. Christmas is commercial,
and the cats always, you know, mess the house up with the trees.
But I like how you differentiated the cultural versus the religious.
Yeah.
You know, like you like the celebratory,
the food,
the hoopla. But.
And her family, you know, always did Christmas big. She came from a family of 10 kids. And so we always did Christmas with her family. And
yeah, there was 10. Yeah, it was big.
They speaking of family, how was the family support for you, Judy? I mean, they welcome you in and vice versa, your family?
Well, my family, I mean, my parents, coming out to my parents was not easy. It was quite a difficult thing. And I guess I was out, I think, to my mom by the time I was with Mary, but not my dad. And it was difficult. My dad was never super, super happy about me being in a relationship with a woman. So I think he would have been happier me being with a man and not happy than being with a woman and happy.
Did he ever say those words?
He didn't say that, but he did say, you know, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to talk about it. It's not something that I agree with. He always kind of tolerated Mary.
Uh-huh. We'll get more deeper into that when we come back, but go ahead.
My family was supportive. Yeah, they were. I have a brother that's gay. They were supportive. Yeah. And they was like, oh, you're gay. Okay. They rolled with my mom too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was fine with it. She was supportive. It didn't really matter to my mom. Huh. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll.
But they accepted Judy and they loved her and they had her over and yeah.
I mean, I'm just sitting here thinking about Diana and myself, and the same kind of thing happened with us. My parents didn't really accept me being gay. We didn't talk about it for at least 7 years when we were together. We were just roommates, you know. And Diana's family just embraced me and loved me. And it was always, when are Di and Cher coming? When are Di and Cher coming? And always including me. And then that just wasn't the same with my family. And so I'm just looking at you, Mary, and you're a brown-skinned woman, and Diana's a brown-skinned woman. And both of your families were so welcoming to both Judy and me, very pale white women, you know, but our families weren't. And it's just like, that's just kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah. Well, the religious piece really influenced it on my end, you know. And then the thing about not having kids and, you know, I mean.
But let me ask you a question. Would your parents have been more accepting if Di was Jewish?
I think so.
Yeah.
I really do think so.
And your parents, if I had been Jewish, don't you think your dad?
Maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's that other culture that is like.
Yeah.
Not non-Jewish.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree and say that there wasn't an element of racism in my family background. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's just so interesting because those that are persecuted persecute.
Yeah.
You know?
It's ironic.
It is.
Yeah, that's true.
So you brought a song. We have to take a music break right now. And you brought a song that was your first song you danced to or something.
Right.
Could you introduce your song and then we're going to play it and take a little break?
Chaka
and then we'll get back
Chaka.
To
Ain't Nobody. This is a soulful song. And it's true. When you listen to the lyrics, Ain't Nobody gonna make me happy, make me feel full. And that's why we love this song.
Yeah.
When we heard it for the first time at the dance, the black and white dance, we knew it was our dance.
Mm.
It was our song.
We hear Chaka Khan with Ain't Nobody.
So
if you're just joining us, you're listening to Living Proof on Outbeat Radio right here on KRCB FM Radio 91. And if you love Outbeat Radio like we do, you can call us right now with your donation and keep this show coming live to you every Sunday night. Got some great thank you gifts as well, so give us a call right now at 707-584-2020. That's 584-2020. Or you can go online to krcb.org, browse the gifts, and make your donation right there. How was that?
That was good. That was good. I hope everybody who's listening can come and help us out a little bit. This is a soft sell, not a hard sell. So, and like Greg said, any amount of donation, you get a Sonoma Strong t-shirt. So
Sonoma Strong.
Can't lose on that. We are back in studio with Judy Evenier and Mary Mendoza. Hello. We were talking about your families and your navigating your relationship. And we are wanting to know a little bit about your coming out story. Like each of you, how old were you when you knew you were going to be a lesbian? Or
is that how you identify? I don't know. But if you want to share that too.
I'll start.
Okay, Mary.
I used to say lesbian. It would be so hard to say that word. A lot of shame filled with it early on for me. But how I found out, I was 32.
Oh.
32. Wow. And I always knew, but you never said. Like, I remember watching commercials and, you know, a guy and a girl kissing, and I would just stare at the girl, not the guy, and I knew something was with that. But it wasn't until, I don't know why this book was in my mom's bathroom, all places. It was the book Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, remember? And there was a section on lesbianism or homosexuality, I forgot. And I read it, and in the bathroom, I turned red. Mm-hmm. Like, this is me, this is me. I knew it was me. Mm-hmm. And then it was a process. But like I said, I didn't come out till I was 32. Oh, I know why I did. I just remembered. I'm a survivor of stuff. And it wasn't until my brother Victor passed away and I was able to go to therapy. I remember he died in January, went to therapy that same month, and I told the therapist, okay, I want to deal with my brother's death and that I'm gay. It was like his death allowed me to be free and to come out. And that's how the process of that happened.
When did you know again? I didn't get
it. I always knew when I was gay. I always knew, but just couldn't say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or act on it, do anything.
Oh, I remember in elementary school having crushes on Luis Perez and all the girls. And, oh, yeah, just you couldn't admit it or say it or call it for what it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How was that for you to hold that for 32 years?
Stress.
So that's when you held stress.
Because finally, when I did come out, I would ask people, how did you know? And their answer would be, you always look stressed.
Ooh. Meaning you don't look stressed anymore.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So they knew.
They knew something, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, Judy?
Well, I, had crushes on my teachers from kindergarten, so I always knew I was different. And then I was Orthodox growing up, and it was a little bit easier to sort of not deal with it because we were kind of separate, boys and girls, growing up in that life. But I never stopped having crushes on girls, and all my little friends had little boyfriends, and I never did. And so, being in the Orthodox world made it easy in some ways because, I got to just be around the girls and not have to deal with the dating thing because there certainly was no pressure there in that life to be dating, But it was a lot of pressure being the daughter of Holocaust survivors who wanted me to get married and have children and being, in this Orthodox world where, by the time I was 18, pretty much half of the girls that I, went through high school with were already married, so
it was 18, huh?
Oh, yeah.
And were they match mixed, you know, match.
Some of them were
maker.
Yeah, some of them were like that, but you know, a lot of them kind of hooked up with boys that we just all grew up together in the Jewish world and in the Jewish youth group we were all in. And I was actually went to Israel the year after high school to try to give it one more shot to be Orthodox, but you know, that's pretty much when I came out and just started acknowledging that this is what I, you know, who I am and more crushes. So when I came back to the States and went to college, that pretty much I started just diving into that world.
Judy, you should tell people that you're the only child too.
Yeah.
So there was that.
Only daughter of two Holocaust survivors. There was kind of a little bit of pressure to get married and have kids.
So did you saying you heard that from your parents?
Well, it's just understood that that's what I would do.
Unspoken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, most Holocaust survivors expected their kids to have kids.
Could you say more about that?
Well, you know, there had to be some, first of all, some joy for the parents who suffered so much. And then, of course, you had to make up for what was lost. It was just, it's just sort of part and parcel of the Orthodox world, the Holocaust survivor world. Yeah.
Did that impact you in some way? I mean, can you speak?
Well, I felt a lot of guilt as I came out and started dealing more with my sexuality that I wasn't going to be giving my parents what, you know, they really wanted. And that was a source of guilt for many, many years. Mary and I even thought about having kids, but that wouldn't have been what made them happy, for sure not. And, you know, it's not like today where a lot of couples are having kids. I mean, we came out, it was early 90s. It just wasn't that way then.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to tell your parents that, sorry, I'm not?
Yeah, I mean, my mom had a hard time with me coming out. But as she got to know Mary, I mean, it made a big difference. And before she died, she was able to tell me that she was happy for me because I had found someone who made me happy. Mm. And she really loved Mary. So
yeah,
that made a difference.
That's nice. That's
beautiful.
I want to ask you questions kind of getting away from your coming out stories and your relationship and getting back into your work, because I'm very curious about the fires and how you were both impacted by the fires as well as your clients.
Mm-hmm.
And Judy, could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, a lot of my clients were displaced. I had one particular client who was living with his niece in a mobile home in that mobile park that pretty much got destroyed there by Kaiser. And I had another client who actually passed away, who was wheelchair bound, who got stuck in her house. Mm. So and then of course working for home health in Santa Rosa, there were just tons of people that were displaced and they had to go to other places. And it was a very chaotic period. And then of course, on my end, having to have my bags packed and not knowing when my time will come to have to evacuate if the fires were going to come to Petaluma. So it was quite stressful. And Mary and I had been displaced from our home in the 1994 earthquake in Northridge. And we were kind of living out of our home for a couple of weeks till we found another place to live. So I was having a lot of sort of PTSD reminiscent kind of feelings throughout that week or two, just on my end, because I was waiting to have to be evacuated. And I'm gonna let Mary talk about her experience, but it was stressful. And so when people are talking about how stressful that period was, I mean, lots of my clients were coming in and talking about the fires and people who even didn't have to evacuate, but environment of watching other people be displaced and losing their homes and not knowing if it's going to impact you, it's a very stressful thing. And if you do have any kind of PTSD in your background, it certainly can get re-stimulated.
And I'm a person with delayed emotions or reactions. Like Judy's thing is, Mary, we need to pack. And I was like, okay, I didn't think we needed to pack. Again, I'm a person that kind of stays in denial. But I've learned, being with Judy, it's important for her that I pack. So that's what I did. And I packed all my stuff. But really, it's like I'd rather bury my head in the sand. And just, that's what I do. And I'd like, oh, so like in the 94 earthquake, what happened then is, you know, it was a big 94 earthquake. It was big. Well, Judy's, you know, dealing with the situation. Me, I went to the car and went to sleep. And I think that's a really good remedy. But I learned it from my mom, because in the, there was one in 71, a big one in San Fernando, Selmar earthquake. The earthquake happened, and 10 kids get up. In the morning, my mom sees us and she makes sure the house is okay. And she just said, okay, it's fine. Go back to sleep. And then we discovered later how bad the earthquake was. And that's kind of my way of coping. Like, it's, I learned not to fret, kind of. I did pack the bags. I did. And I know now with the relation with Judy, I thought this is important to her. Although I don't agree with the packing, I'm going to pack and do it. And yeah.
I think people come to those conclusions when you actually, I guess I'll talk for me, when Diana wants me to do something and I don't really want to, but I do it because I know it's important to her.
Yeah.
And I trust her. And I think that's what I'm hearing underneath the words, even though you didn't say those words, that you trust Judy, you trust her judgment, even though it's not yours. You know, she has a good head on her shoulders, and so you just did it.
Right, right. Yeah. And that's what, yeah, yeah. But in regards to my clients, I think a lot of people are who have survived traumatic past get really triggered by these disasters. And yeah, you'll see a lot of people have a lot of PTSD coming up, and that my clients, people are a lot more needy. You need to check on them, make sure, give a reassuring phone call. Most seniors live alone. All my seniors that I deal with.
But you're in San Rafael. Are you saying that your folks were impacted by the fires?
The air, the quality of the air, yeah. Definitely, we were making, the quality of the air was really bad, even for me. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it for you? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've been hearing that too for seniors all over. Yeah. San Francisco. Yeah.
Check on them. And then our office, we have a Jewish Family Children's Services office in Santa Rosa. Mm-hmm. So we were connected with all that was going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those seniors really, I mean, the people had to be displaced. They're frail to begin with, and I mean, we're involved because they're homebound and sick, and then to have to move out of your home and deal with fire, it was very stressful for a lot of people.
How do you hold all the sadness that you've been, you know, listening to, and especially with seniors, you know, because seniors is a whole different, you know, thing or energy that goes there. How do you take care of yourselves?
Well, yeah, that's a really important question. And it was kind of challenging for those 2 weeks, you know. And I was also kind of, you know, trying to help at my temple. And, you know, I went over and to see if there was something I can do, because people were in the temple and staying there. And I was feeling pulled in lots of different directions, and there was a part of me feeling like, oh my God, how can I help so many people? And I finally kind of, actually, my body broke down and I got sick, and I ended up in the house just sort of resting because it was just too much. And probably, I think, being able to say, you know, it's okay not that you can't take care of 10 million people all at the same time, you know. Yeah. is a really important when there's a disaster. You're right. We have to take care of ourselves as much as taking care of everybody else.
Yeah, I contributed money, and I'm not usually one that does that. That helped me. And I know the work that I do is meaningful, so I feel like I'm contributing there. And taking care of myself, definitely. Go to the gym, work out, do things that are nurturing, go to bed on time, get ready for work. You know, get all that self-care stuff. Mm-hmm. Take time to, I do meditation, I do journaling, all that good stuff that makes, you know, you mm-hmm. there for the next day for your clients. It makes a big difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, the self-care is really important.
Diana and I were just at a grief ritual today earlier, and they talked about having to let out all of the grief that we were holding at this ritual, so it can be, we can be empty of it to be able to go out into the world and then hold other people's grief. Since we've emptied ours, then we have more room for other people. But if you hold on and hold on and hold on and you can't let it out, then you don't have, there's no room for anybody else. You can't help other people. So self-care is so important.
It is. It's so important.
And some people feel selfish if they do self-care, you know, like they feel guilty. I should be helping. And not going to the gym or not sleeping, you know. But like you said, they get sick, right, Judy? Yeah.
Yeah. Grief is a powerful thing if we can allow it to happen. And they mentioned today about how difficult it is for people to allow themselves to grieve. But I always tell people, because I mean, the last couple of weeks have been really stressful for so many people, that people grieve on their own time.
Yeah.
And we can't push everybody to meet our timetable. And so that's the message I want to put out into the community. You know, when you say people are holding or in denial, mm-hmm. you know, it's not necessary denial. People takes time. People are getting their houses in order, finding a place to live. They're basic things that they have to do, you know, find shelter.
And they can't really, I would think, I don't know, but if they're busy with all of the logistics, they can't really even sit and think for a moment about the impacts mm-hmm. until they're all settled into their new surroundings and they're alone maybe. And it's just like, wow, mm-hmm. what just happened?
Well, through my own experience with grief, to me, and I've always said this, is like you're in the ocean. The waves come and you don't know when the wave of grief is going to knock you over. Mm-hmm. It can be at the most weird time. And that's the thing with grief. You don't know when it's going to hit you and bowl you over. That's been my experience. So you just write it. Like when it comes, cry, let it out. And just, you know, because if you don't, that's when the sickness and all that. Mm. Yeah.
And the thing is about grief, like you were saying, Diana, when, you know, we're all kind of used to hearing about the different stages. But, you know, people do it differently. You know, some people stay in the anger stage. Some people stay in the denial stage longer. Some people are in the sadness stage. You know, it just really has to do with who we are, and honoring the way we do it is fine. And I also think it's so important to remember that previous trauma, previous griefs, losses that people experienced, you know, are going to be brought up by current losses, by current experiences. So I think this period has brought up a lot of old things for people, and that has to be honored as well. And, you know, people might say, God, what's wrong with me? Why am I experiencing this? So I didn't have to leave. I wasn't evacuated. But, you know, it's important that people just kind of just respect the fact that they're having their feelings and old things might be coming up, and that's very normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for speaking that, because that is so true. We get triggered by other things and they show up, and people say, you know, I was in a conversation with someone and it was about their parents, missing their parents versus the fire, you know? So it's like,
Just wanting that comfort.
Just the grief, just loss. Just, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, we are at the time where we have to say goodbye. And so we always like to ask our guests for words of wisdom. And we know you were just giving us some really great words of wisdom regarding the fire and stress and PTSD and things. But are there other things that you would like to impart upon us? Other philosophies you have of life, maybe about relationships or
being, yeah,
life in general?
I think for Judy and me, the real important thing is the laughter. Like for me, a big way to deal with stress and sadness and is to laugh. Like that for me is the way I handle it, using a sense of humor, lightness, because without it, I'd be nuts.
And thank God I have a partner who knows how to laugh and has taught me how to laugh, because I didn't know how to laugh 30
really?
Years ago. Yeah, Mary definitely has taught me how to laugh. It's definitely good to laugh at life, mm-hmm, and not take yourself so seriously.
Yeah. And another one, you hear it all the time, but for me, it's made it to be in the moment. You know, we hear that so much today, be in the moment, but it's true. That's the thing. That's why we hear it so much. It is so true that this is all we have, and be grateful for it. Live in that moment. Soak it up. Bask in it. You know,
just never know.
You never know.
Live today.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Think like about tomorrow, but live today.
Yeah. And I like the word succulent. Mm. And that's what like life is. Just like if you each moment hold on to it.
Mm. Wow. Thank you, Diane. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. This has been great.
Really nice.
So much that you can be here and share this hour with us. Thank you.
It's been my honor.
Yeah, mine too.
We want everyone to remember that, like Judy and Mary, that you too can be living proof, and through sharing your story, you can support others in being free and living their lives authentically. It's another way to help the world. Like them, Mary and Judy, you too can be visible and vibrant in telling your story. And this is Diana and Sheridan, and we'll be back next month. Until then,
good night.
What have you done today to make you feel proud? It's never too late to try. What have you done today to make you feel proud? Mm-hmm. You could be so many people if you make that grab for freedom. What have you done today?
Join us next Sunday night for Outbeat Music. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCBFM Radio 91. And remember, you can still get your Sonoma Strong t-shirt and support KRCB Radio by going online right now and making a tax-deductible donation of $40 or more. Just go to krcb.org and click the red donate button. It's just before 9 p.m. Stay with us. Afropop Worldwide is next. Change, yeah, so do it today, yeah, 'cause I can see you there.